I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, what makes so many young men from a small town in Libya join the insurgency in Iraq? It's apparently not Osama bin Laden. It's a figure immortalized by actor Anthony Quinn in an American movie. We'll explain. But first, the economy again, more troubling numbers again. The Labor Department reports that new claims for unemployment benefits jumped by 35,000 last week, double the number analysts expected. At the same time, soaring prices for food, gasoline, and other everyday needs pushed consumer spending up at a faster pace than expected for the month of March. And overall, construction spending dropped by just over 1% in March. That's the fifth decline in the past 6 months. Housing construction was down nearly 5%. Peter Coy is economic editor for Business Week. He joins us. And Peter, a lot of numbers out today. Let's start with the jobless claims. You know, some analysts expected 18,000 new claims, actually almost double that. So where are we with unemployment right now?
I think we're talking about recessionary levels of unemployment. There was a little hope earlier this week that we might get a positive number for April, but it's looking now like we're going to see tomorrow, crucial number coming out, unemployment is likely to increase in April, which will be yet another sign that the economy has probably fallen into a recession.
Well, and the numbers that we have today are just from last week. 35,000 new claims for unemployment benefits, bringing the total number to 380,000. These are just initial claims?
Right, the initial claims, the total number of people actually receiving unemployment insurance is over 3 million. And this just fits with the overall pattern of weakness in the economy. You mentioned consumer spending. It was up a little more than expected, but that was just because inflation was higher.
Mm-hmm.
The adjusted for inflation, spending was up only 0.1%. Or look at wages. Over the past year, a number came out today, adjusted for inflation, wages are up only 0.1%. for the whole year to date.
Well, and the consumer spending, that, as you're saying, that doesn't represent consumer confidence.
Not at all. Consumer confidence is exceptionally weak. Home Depot today announced that it's closing 15 stores and scrapping plans for opening 50 new ones. You know, across the board, we're seeing a lot of weakness. The Federal Reserve, as you know, cut interest rates yesterday. And some people are predicting that it'll pause, it won't cut for again for a while, but what we're writing in Business Week is that very likely the Fed is going to have to keep putting in more cuts because of the pervasive weakness in the economy.
Well, what about the tax rebate checks that are starting to land in mailboxes?
Yeah, those will help, but they're almost completely offset by the higher price of gasoline and food. You know, what comes in, one pocket goes right out the other. And of course, that's temporary. It'll help spending towards the end of the second quarter, beginning of the third quarter, but then it's going to go away, and we're going to be right back where we were.
Peter, how much does this become self-fulfilling? You know, you mentioned Home Depot shutting down 15 stores. The first time the chain has closed a flagship store for performance-based reasons, people not going in and buying the things to build houses, and, you know, it's just a, you know, sort of a domino effect.
Yeah. Recessions always have a self-fulfilling component, where one person cuts back and that's money out of somebody else's pocket and things do spiral downward. They eventually find a floor and then we build back from there. But because of the enormous overhang of debt in this economy, it's going to be a long while, I think, before that happens.
Peter Coy, economic editor for Business Week magazine. Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
The Los Angeles Times reported recently that dissent within al-Qaeda is so intense that a top leader held an online question-and-answer session with followers angry about tactics, including the killing of innocent Muslims. But according to the U.S. State Department's just-released report on terrorism, al-Qaeda has rebuilt some of its pre-September 11th capabilities and restored control by top leadership. The report claims al-Qaeda's resilience is partly due to alliances with local groups in the Middle East and North Africa. Well, one source for that thinking may be a list of names discovered when American forces raided a local insurgent headquarters in northern Iraq late last year. On that list, information about 606 foreign fighters. As expected, most were from Saudi Arabia, Osama bin Laden's home country. But the surprise was how many came from Libya. Of those, how many volunteered to be suicide bombers, and how many, over 50, came from the small town of Darna. Well, Newsweek Jerusalem Bureau Chief Kevin Perino traveled to Darna to understand why its young men were joining al-Qaeda-linked groups in Iraq, thousands of miles away. The answer is fascinating and starts with a history lesson. And Kevin joins us now from Jerusalem. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What a fascinating story, because you found that propelling these young men in part is past history with the United States, history many Americans don't even remember. It has to do with the Barbary Wars against the Barbary pirates in the early 1800s?
Yeah, that was one of the striking things about this find, is that 50 of these fighters came from this single town, Darna, which has really a very kind of rich history. It's the site of one of the key battles in America's first overseas invasion during the Barbary Wars in the early 1800s. And, you know, at this period of time, the former colonies were newly liberated, and they couldn't count on the protection of the British Empire in the Mediterranean anymore. And so they were these ships that Americans were using to export cotton and to export tobacco, things like that, were increasingly falling victim to pirates from what the Americans called the Barbary States, which included places like Tripoli, other cities in Algeria and Morocco.
This is the former Ottoman Empire.
Exactly right. At that time, they were kind of semi-autonomous regencies. There was a debate about whether do we pay these pirates off or do we confront them militarily. And eventually Thomas Jefferson in 1801 sent a force to the coast of Libya. And it started badly. The USS Philadelphia ran aground near Tripoli, and it was captured by the Tripolitans. It was put on display as a trophy there. And he had to send somebody who later became a hero, Stephen Decatur, on this kind of daring midnight raid to burn down the USS Philadelphia. So it wouldn't be used by the pirates, and also probably as a morale thing, so it wouldn't be used as a trophy sitting there in the harbor. And then there was a general named William Eaton. He marched land troops. It was across the desert from Alexandria, Egypt, to Darna. This was a small contingent of Marines. I think there were 7 U.S. Marines, which is a young force at that time, and a much larger contingent of local mercenaries marched across the desert to Darna. Eaton rode his horse up to the old city's gate and demanded the city's surrender. The local governor said, "My head or yours," and the battle ensued. Mm. To the shores of Tripoli line in the Marine hymn is actually from that battle. That was as far as the Marines got toward Tripoli. And this fighting in Darna really has left a legacy on the town. When you visit, one of the first things you see as you're driving into town is these giant yellow concrete numerals advertising the 1805 resort. And one of the most popular restaurants in this town is called the Philadelphia Fast Food Restaurant, named after the USS Philadelphia. And this is, you know, keep in mind, this is a small town. And so it really does, this past that we only sort of remember as a stray question on a forgotten exam is something that's really, has an impact on people who live there.
In fact, you show a picture in Newsweek of what Libyans claim is the frigate from the USS Philadelphia atop, a building there. They still have this mast on display. I mean, this is very present, this battle. In fact, they refer to this as the first U.S.-Libyan war.
Exactly. And they see it as a point of national pride, the capture of the Philadelphia. Somebody who worked at one of the Philadelphia fast food restaurants who I was talking to said it, you know, Libya was the first country to take on America. I talked to a history teacher who teaches 10-year-olds, and he said he draws kind of simple pictures of the Philadelphia for his students, and they're too young to remember Eaton and Decatur and names like that, but they do, they can get a sense of, that sense of pride that telling the story can give them.
Well, a sense of pride from that battle, and as you say, the fact that it was even immortalized in the Marine hymn, you know, to the shores of Tripoli, but then a sense of deep hatred for a battle that came later against Italy and Italy's occupation. Tell us about that.
Exactly, yeah. In 1911, Italian colonial forces landed in the port of Darna, and the Italian occupation, which lasted until the Axis powers were defeated in World War II, was incredibly brutal. There were concentration camps, there were mass executions that one scholar of Libya told me bordered on genocide. School children were taught to recite sentences like, I'm happy to be subject to the Italian government, and the Duce loves all children, even Arab children. This is what they were taught during this period. And that colonial presence really did have a lasting impact, much more even than the Barbary Wars did on the town. And the effect that it all had is to engender a kind of strong Islamic resistance that's centered around a guy named Omar al-Mukhtar. There's a 1981 movie called Lion of the Desert starring Anthony Quinn about his life and role. Mukhtar was educated by a secretive sect of called the Senussis, who ran these what they called Senussi lodges in eastern Libya. And it was a sect that was influenced to some degree by the conservative puritanical Wahhabi sect in Saudi Arabia. So that's the world that this Mukhtar is coming from. And he fought for 20 years with little bands of guerrillas against the Italians. And he was eventually captured. He died in captivity in 1931. But this legacy is really omnipresent in Darna and all over eastern Libya. And you see more pictures of Omar al-Mukhtar than you do of Muammar Gaddafi in eastern Libya. His face is on posters on the doors of mosques. His face is on window stickers of cars. It's even on the currency there. And in Darna, one day I went to this club called the Hyena Society. It's sort of this historical club, this kind of weird place with these stuffed cobras and Ottoman-era carbines and Bedouin tents. And I met a guy who showed me a picture that he had painted of Omar al-Mukhtar, and in the picture, the eyes, he said, look carefully at the eyes, and I looked at them, and he said, I painted this on the night of Saddam Hussein's execution, and the eyes that you see in this painting of Omar al-Mukhtar are actually Saddam Hussein's. And so you can see Saddam Hussein could be a stand-in for somebody who's considered a hero in Darna, this Omar al-Mukhtar.
In fact, when you were in Darna, family members told you of young men watching the American movie Lion of the Desert about Omar Mukhtar over and over again. Here's an edited scene in which Mukhtar, played by Anthony Quinn, is negotiating with the Italian occupiers.
We are not Italians who do not tell us that we are. We were born where we were born, only by the will of God, and only by our own mothers. We are not you. We must have a national parliament.
The parliament is a matter for Rome. We will note your demand.
Mark it well. The confiscated lands must be given back.
Well, now I wouldn't say confiscated lands.
Why do you think we fight you?
A habit on religious authority that your Quran does not permit you to fight a war you cannot win.
Now you are going to interpret our religion for us. The book leaves no doubt. It is our duty to God to defend ourselves against those who have driven us out of our homes.
A scene from the film Lion in the Desert. When we come back, Kevin Perino is going to take us inside the homes of young Libyans inspired by that film. And later today, we'll speak with writer Joe Drape. He'll speak of the volumes of great writing produced by that two-minute race, the Kentucky Derby, coming up this Saturday. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from Newsweek Jerusalem Bureau Chief Kevin Perino. He traveled to the small town of Darna in eastern Libya after 52 of that town's young men showed up on a list of insurgents and suicide bombers in Iraq. And Kevin discovered that part of their inspiration for fighting the U.S. in Iraq was historic. They still remember that their ancestors fought America on the shores of Tripoli back in the 1800s when the U.S. battled the Barbary pirates. And in addition, Libya was brutally occupied by Italy under Mussolini. In fact, the Libyan insurgency against the Italians was immortalized in the American movie The Lion in the Desert, which is still very popular in Libya. But Kevin, it can't only be history that turned these young men into militants. Why else did they go to Iraq?
One reason is the economy, and it's not an answer to everything, but it's something that you notice immediately when you're in town, is the eastern part of Libya is significantly poorer than the western part of Libya. Some people say, when you talk to them in Tripoli, that that's deliberate to sort of keep these restive eastern provinces down. What I saw there when I was talking to people is young men with bleak lives in search of redemption. Some of that is certainly the economy, but that doesn't explain everything. I mean, there are tens of millions of impoverished Muslims around the world, and only a handful, maybe a few hundred at a time, are fighting in Iraq. So there are other factors, and once you were there and you really started listening to people, you see that there are all kinds of personal factors that motivated some of these guys, in addition to the economy, in addition to the historical background, things like sibling rivalry, psychological trauma, and even whether they were able to marry or not.
Well, and let's talk about some of the people you met, because you sat in the living rooms, you sat in the homes of the families whose sons had gone. Abd al-Hamid, for instance, was the older brother of Abd al-Salam bin Ali, who had disappeared, someone who would sit in front of the television and watch Lion of the Desert over and over again, watch Al Jazeera, watch pictures coming back from Iraq. You know, why does his family think he might have gone?
This was a pretty young guy. He was 20 years old, and he didn't have a lot going for him. He was described as kind of awkward, kind of pale and lanky. He was blind in one eye. He had studied to be a veterinarian in school, but when he graduated, he couldn't find a job, and so he ended up selling perfumes in Darna's old city. When you don't have a steady job in a place like Darna, it's very difficult to get married. He's still living with his mother in their house, and as you said, watching movies and watching increasingly Al Jazeera as the war in Iraq went on. And so this Abdul Salam had just been talking about it for months before he went, and his brother told me I was sure he would go. And then one day he just slipped out of town, and he called a few days later and said, I'm in Ramadi.
How did these families react to you asking about their sons? I mean, it seemed to be sort of a mix of defiance in some cases. You know, we believe the war in Iraq is a terrible thing. We're proud of our children. But then what would come out, you know, that defiance seemed to be masking, you know, heartbreak.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the first reaction that I would get when I would show up is fear. Sometimes they would ask me, you know, what do you know where he is? How can I find him? Do you know, sort of seeing me, as in their eyes a conduit to an American world that they had little access to, trying to find their sons. But most people that I stopped by to see eventually invited me in to talk to their homes. And they saw it as an opportunity to sort of get on the soapbox and talk a little bit about their views of the war, which were, as you can imagine, entirely negative. And it did mask a certain amount of heartbreak. I interviewed this one father. He had four sons, and one of his sons had gone to Iraq in the spring of 2007. And we all kind of sat around in his living room, and he had other sons there who were saying, I'm thinking about going. And the father was kind of looking at them saying, you're not allowed to go. He said to me, this guy over here has no passport. He's not going.
Is this the same father that leans into you at one point and says, if I give you a camel, will you bring back my son?
Exactly. Yeah, that's what he said. As we were leaving, he kind of leaned in conspiratorially and said, "If you can find a way to bring him back, I'll give you a camel."
Well, so meanwhile, Kevin, what is Muammar Gaddafi and Libya's role in all of this? As you write, Libya's gone through some sort of transformation. It's considered one of the Bush administration's few triumphs in the war on terror. Of course, Gaddafi behind the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, but then years later gave up its weapons of mass destruction program, is trying to come into the fold of the West. Is it thought that Gaddafi is behind sending these young men to Iraq?
Most people don't think so. And, the conventional wisdom is that Islamic militants coming back from fighting in Iraq would be a nightmare for Gaddafi. The people that I talk to in Libya and, in the diplomatic community think that Gaddafi would like to stop this as much as the Americans would.
Well, meanwhile, some Americans are trying to think of innovative ways to do it, and I just want to leave on that note because it really jumped out at us. These young men from Darna are being recruited into a network. They're being smuggled, sort of taken off into Iraq. And you spoke to an official who said, instead of trying to fight this network, we should buy them off.
Yeah, exactly. And he's not referring to the actual fighters. He's referring to this this network of smugglers. Most of the fighters from Darna would travel by land from eastern Libya to Cairo. Then they would fly from Cairo to Damascus and be smuggled in from Damascus to northern Iraq. And what this analyst was saying is a lot of the times the people actually doing the smuggling, not the fighters themselves, are just, you know, they're just criminal networks. They're just smuggling networks that are motivated only by profit.
It's just an astonishing thought that, you know, after all is said and done, that it might be easier to co-opt some of these middlemen and staunch this flow of fighters than fight them.
I would suspect that military officials in Iraq are already doing some of this as they've sort of watched the success of the Anbar Salvation Council and the projects that that they're doing, kind of paying off some of these local tribal leaders. I would bet that some of that's already going on. Hmm.
That's Newsweek Jerusalem Bureau Chief Kevin Perino. His article about the small town in Libya sending a large number of suicide bombers and fighters to Iraq appears in a recent issue. We'll hook you up at our website, here-now.org. Kevin, fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, Errol Morris on reframing Abu Ghraib and his new film, Standard Operating Procedure. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, flying on a wing and a Hebrew prayer. After the news, Here and Now. This Saturday is the first Saturday in May, and that means one thing: pounding hooves, pounding hearts, characters who talk out of the corner of their mouths and use words like pal. Well, they used to anyway.
As all readers of bad fiction know, horsemen are callous schemers, steeped in guile, to whom a thoroughbred royal lineage and generous courage is merely a tool to be used while it can produce money and then discarded or destroyed. In movies, they talk out of the corner of the mouth, almost always in conspiratorial tones, because they are almost always conspiring to fix a race, break a jockey's arm, swindle a sucker, or nobble another man's horse.
The great sports writer Red Smith wrote those words in 1978. By the way, nobble another man's horse means steal another man's horse. How do I know that? I asked Joe Drape, who knows all things horse racing. He read Red's words for us and has compiled them in the words of other great writers in the new book, To the Swift, Triple Crown Horses and Their Race for Glory. It's just in time for Saturday's 134th running of the Kentucky Derby, the first jewel in the Triple Crown. Just 11 horses have won the crown. That means winning the Derby, then the Preakness, and finally the Belmont. Affirmed was the last in 1978. Joe Drape covers horse racing for the Times. His writing is also in the new book, and he joins us from Louisville, site of Saturday's Kentucky Derby. Joe, welcome back to Here and Now.
Robin, love being here.
From Red Smith to Jane Smiley, there is great writing in this book. What is it about horse racing that attracts writers?
You know, there's something lyrical, not only about watching a horse race, but writing about it. And my theory on that is a horse race lasts 2 minutes. So your imagination really has to fly. It really has to take wing and let it go and fill up that prose, 1,000 words, 2,000 words. And also, it's the last democratic sport left. As long as you get up at 6 a.m, you wander through the barn area, you can talk to George Steinbrenner in the track kitchen, who might be sitting next to a $200-a-week groom. The love of horses mends a lot of fences among rich, poor, educated, non-educated.
Well, and what these horses do, it seems, is, you know, they allow us to put our dreams on their backs. As we said, the last Triple Crown winner was affirmed in 1978. Steve Cady, is it?
Yes, Steve Cady.
Previewed that race with this writing. Let me just read it here. If racehorses are the nonviolent weapons used by the rich to wage vicarious combat, Affirmed and Aladar are the ultimate weapons about to be detonated in the 104th running of America's favorite horse race. Seldom have 2 3-year-old thoroughbreds with such awesome credentials faced each other in the opener of racing's annual Triple Crown series. Tell us about the races that rivalry produced.
These were the two best horses on the planet at the time, and everybody knew the showdown was going to come in the Triple Crown. And Affirmed, what he did is he ran from the front and dared anybody to come catch him. It was sort of like the old Seabiscuit War Admiral thing. There was firm lines drawn of if you're an Alley Durr or an Affirmed guy. We have a place in the office, a big old picture of Ali Dar and affirmed. People walk by there, horse players who are there, work for the New York Times, and they declare themselves affirmed or Ali Dar guys right there in front of that picture.
You have to choose a side. Well, you know, I want to say, we've talked to you about this at length. What do you say to people who think horse racing is inhumane? I mean, you've in the past told us that, you know, the horses love it. How do you know the horses love it?
You know, if you walk down a shed row in the afternoon and the call to post was played, every horse's head, and I've done this, would pop out of his stall and look around. That is what they love to do, is run. Now, is there some cruel tragedies that occur? Absolutely. I've been around these folks. I mean, the Barbaro, the last time you and I talked, yeah, I spent 9 months doing nothing but watching Barbaro and getting to know the people there. These horsemen treat these animals tremendously. They love them.
Well, you know, let's stay with Barbaro, the heartbreaking story of Barbaro injured. Everyone was pulling for the horse to, you know, come back, but he had to be put down. You say, you know, the horse owners loved him. They made a classic mistake of falling in love with their horse.
Gretchen Jackson, and she's the one who said, I made the mistake, I fell in love with my horse. I mean, by if that was any other horse, Robin, he would have been euthanized there on the track at Preakness. A couple positive things have come out of there. Equine medicine was a big winner. They learned some new techniques. And now there's a switch which is really bothering horse players this week to synthetic surfaces, which are safer and softer.
So it'd be better for the horses. They aren't as likely to pull up lame. But you also write, he raised the public's awareness about anti-slaughterhouse legislation, the number of horses that have been, you know, slaughtered. You write, beyond his talent, his human connections were beguiled by his personality, which blended intelligence with an old soul's temperament. Quoting one of his, trainers. How did you see that? How did people see that?
Well, I mean, he was just a superb animal to look at. I mean, he had wings of Pegasus. Second, he was a wise horse. Everybody points to, and I believe it, when he broke down in the Preakness, he stopped. He held his leg up. So he really had this sense of, I know who I am. I want to live. Come save me.
Well, and another great horse was eulogized on the editorial pages of the New York Times, Secretariat, in 1989. They also mention Pegasus, the end of Pegasus, they write. Even the least sentimental among us may wish for some kind of heavenly pasture for Secretariat. He was a glorious creature, this copper-colored stallion, and he has earned his wings. On the other hand, you have Nellie Bly, you know, who was writing in 1894 in the New York World. Her headline, Wild Vortex of Gambling and Betting by Men, Women, and Children, despairing over the fact that gamblers, horse owners, jockeys, millionaires, and actors mingle together promiscuously. What kind of writing jumps out at you from the book about the business of horse racing?
You know, the business of horse racing is more of a phenomenon that begins in the 70s around Secretariat. Secretariat was the first stallion syndicated while he was still racing.
Wait a minute. What about I got a horse right here? His name is Paul Revere.
Those guys were gambling. On Secretariat, they weren't gambling. This was a great steed that they said, here's $19 million. We're going to breed you when you're done racing. So, you know, it's good you bring the Nellie Bly up. People forget. It was the one and only sport founded on gambling. It began in the Revolutionary War and was imported from England, where I've got the fastest horse. I'll bet you $100. People forget Andrew Jackson spent hundreds of thousands of dollars betting and racing horses, and he was in the White House. He even had a stable of racehorses there. Huh. You know, the $2 better. He's also invested in the horse emotionally and plus his $2, you know. Barbaro, I think, paid $13. So a lot of people put $2 down, fell in love with him because he won and got $13 back. I go back to the democracy of it, and it's why Red Smith, Arthur Daly, Dave Anderson, that's why they liked it so much, because you could go and see all stratas of life there.
Joe Drabe also covers horse racing for the New York Times and is the editor of the new book, To the Swift, Triple Crown Horses and Their Race for Glory. And by the way, Joe, who's your pick for Saturday? Who should we watch?
Big Brown is the buzz horse. He's only raced 3 times. He's crushed all his opponents. I am not picking Big Brown. Big Brown's trying to do too much, and he has sore hooves. So I'm looking at quite a few, including Colonel John from the West Coast.
Okay, put your $2 down. Joe, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Okay, quick look ahead. Next week on Here and Now, as Hoosiers hold a primary, we'll look back 40 years when RFK was the candidate in Indiana. That's next week. You're listening to Here and Now. When you have one of those white-knuckle flights, how do you cope? Well, Alana Newhouse wrote an article in the New York Times travel section that caught our eye about how she reverted to a childhood prayer, but then came to find a new faith in humanity at 36,000 feet. Alana is the arts and culture editor for the Jewish newspaper The Forward. Let's tell the story, Alana. You were on a six-week book tour for a book of photographs from The Forward. What was the prayer that gave you sustenance?
The prayer is known as the Wayfarer's or the Traveler's Prayer, and I learned it when I was very young. And it was just something that we always said, especially when we took plane rides, but even long car rides.
Well, can you give us the very beginning of the prayer in Hebrew and then in English, and then sum up what the prayer says?
Sure. Yihiratzon lefenecha Hashem Elokeinu v'Elokei Avotenu, shetolichenu l'shalom v'tatzidenu l'shalom v'tagihenu l'shalom v'tagihenu l'mchos chavtenu l'chayim l'simcha l'shalom. And that translates into, may it be your will, Lord, our God and our God of our forefathers, that you lead us toward peace and place our footsteps toward peace, guide us toward peace, and make us reach our desired destinations for life, gladness, and peace.
We understand this is a very old prayer. It goes back to the Talmud and a sense from the prophet Elijah that you should seek some counsel from God before you go on a voyage.
Yes, and the notion is that travel is a time of particular vulnerability. It is when our sins are perhaps the most highlighted or the most looked at. So the notion is that you should seek God's counsel for protection.
At this point in your story, you're obsessing with your sins and trying to be sort of a better person as you go to fly. What were you doing?
I became the best Samaritan ever in the airports of America. I would help anyone who looked like they were in need of any guidance. Any woman with a stroller, anybody who was elderly, if anybody dropped any of their luggage, I would immediately run over and scoop it up and help them. As a way, I guess I felt, of earning credit, as though God was about to have this plane crash, but because I helped this woman out of her wheelchair, he was going to change his mind. It's absurd, but these are also the subconscious things that go on when you're very frightened.
You're on a journey of discovery through this prayer as you go also on the book tour. And one of the things that you discover is that you start to feel like, well, what about other people's sins on the airplane?
That's right. All of a sudden, it occurred to me that if my sins were being looked at, so were everyone else's. So I started to get very suspicious of other passengers and worried that perhaps they were great sinners, such great sinners that they could actually bring the plane down.
Right, right. You could go down for their sins, so to speak. And as you go along, you know, especially with that concern that, geez, you know, how am I going to cover everybody's sins on the airplane? You remember that, in fact, this prayer was deliberately communal, not individual. What did that mean to you?
Right, and I think that was the real moment where this changed from a story of personal faith into one of human experience. I realized that sometimes the best antidote for fear is actually turning to another human being, which is not to say that God isn't a good option, just like Valium and Xanax and alcohol and everything else everybody uses, but also just turning for sustenance to another person who's also afraid and who could live in that fear with you can be comforting.
There was a woman sitting next to you on one of those white-knuckle flights, and you'd put your hands together.
On one of my last flights for the book tour, we hit a patch of turbulence toward the end, and I was sitting next to a woman who was very, very frightened, and at first I didn't think that I could be of any use to her, but then at some point I realized that she was deeply scared, and I turned to look at her, and we ended up holding hands. And when we landed, she looked to me and said, you know, why do I get so scared? It's almost as if I feel I'm going to be punished.
And deserve to be punished, she said.
Right, exactly. As though I deserve to be punished. I deserved to be on a flight that crashes. That brought the entire fear journey into a psychological realm. A lot of this was about sin and punishment and what we feel we deserve and what we're frightened of. And she didn't even know that she actually elucidated the whole issue for me with that one comment, but she did.
And that sent you back to the prayer and to a line that you hadn't seen as clearly before. Do you have that line there?
Whenever one unites himself with the needs of others, he increases the chance that his prayer will be heard. I think that that in many ways is what happened to me. I aligned myself with the needs of somebody else. I don't know who answered my prayer, whether it was her or God or the universe or what, but somehow I did get less frightened.
That's writer Alana Newhouse talking about her spiritual journey as well as a 6-week book tour that she took. Alana, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, looking ahead, let's get all the jokes about gay Paris out of the way. A new musical, takes gay romance in Paris seriously. That's in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A new musical has an unconventional take on Paris in the 60s. In Paris by Night, premiering at Trinity Repertory Company in Providence, Rhode Island, a young American soldier with dreams of becoming a boxer is on a 3-day leave. He meets an émigré, and the two begin tentative steps towards romance, visiting museums, strolling through gardens, and taking a trip to the top of the Eiffel Tower. But the first duet between the couple is a clue that this might not be the affair we remember seeing staged back in the 60s.
Hey, one, we'll stick together.
Hey, two,
in any weather, we know for now that we two can be.
The émigré is Sam, an African-American tattoo artist who sets up shop in Paris. He's played by actor Joe Wilson Jr. James Royce Edwards plays Buck, the soldier boxer who captures Sam's heart. That's just one of the love affairs in Paris by Night. It's written by Trinity Repertory Company's artistic director, Kurt Columbus, with music and lyrics by Andre Plus and Amy Warren. Kurt sat down with Here Now's Ed Siegel after dress rehearsal.
Kurt, you run a major regional theater. You adapt classic works of Dostoevsky and Chekhov. You direct, and you didn't have enough to do, so you decided to write a musical.
Well, you know, Ed, the funny thing is, ever since I was a 10-year-old child memorizing The Sound of Music on 8-track in the front seat of my father's car, I have always been in love with musicals, and I've always wanted to write a musical. So here we are, 33 years later, and it's the realization of a childhood dream in a lot of ways. So yeah, here we are.
So tell us about that childhood. What was it like growing up? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town in western Pennsylvania called Newcastle. It's right on the border with Ohio. And I'll state the question so you don't have to ask it. What was it like growing up gay in a small town in western Pennsylvania? It was isolating and odd. And a lot of my retreat and solace was into things like old movies and musicals. And so therefore, Paris by Night is really an homage to the movies of my childhood and to the American musical theater form.
Daybreak pushes its fingers into the city of night.
And the Parisian setting?
When I was a little kid, when I imagined romance, happening in Paris. So that's why this is not actually Paris of 1960, it's movie Paris of 1960.
What's the difference?
Well, movie Paris is like, I don't know if you remember in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which is one of my favorite movies as well, Jane Russell and Marilyn Monroe show up in Paris and they get in a taxi and Jane Russell leans forward and goes, "Hey, Pierre, we want to go someplace to buy dresses and shoes and belts. Do you know what I mean?" And he goes, "Oh, mais bien sûr, des robes, des chaussures." You know, he suddenly understands her English. She understands his French. "Yeah, that's where we want to go." And, you know, they sing songs out of the blue. Movie Paris is a place where issues of sexuality and race are part of the tapestry, but are dealt with within the musical theater form. I wanted a couple of gay characters, one whom was a boxer and the other whom was a tough-talking, tough-fighting tattoo artist. I wanted to reclaim a kind of masculine norm for gay characters that might be unexpected, but, you know, in I hope will be something that particularly for kids in the audience, you know, young gay men and women like I was 30 years ago, that it'll feel like something they can identify with and use as a model for themselves.
Making some
the star of the show, Joe Wilson Jr. Talk a little bit about working with Joe on this.
He just brings so much complexity. You give him five words, and he will tell the most incredible story. And Sam was never as complicated, tormented, withholding. I mean, Joe's brought all of that himself to the guy. When I started writing this, I was reading a lot of James Baldwin, you know, and Baldwin lived in Paris. And so I had this inspiration of the African-American artist in Paris. And then for years, I couldn't get anybody but white actors to read it. So Sam would not be black, and it lost the heart. And so Joe's brought the heart back.
I have been living in Paris. I had to leave San Francisco. George, don't judge me. But I've taken up my old art again. I've opened up a tattoo parlor. It certainly doesn't compare with having photos in the pages of life. But it's a living.
There's also a more traditional heterosexual relationship between Marie the chanteuse and a macho,
yeah.
a macho serviceman.
Yeah, it was always important to me that there be a relationship that our straight audience would peg into. It's my great hope that people leave the theater and they turn to the person that they're with, and whether it's someone that they've been dating for, you know, a couple of days, or it's the person they've lived with for 25 years, and they'll want to kiss that person. That's my great hope with this musical.
I want you so bad, girl, can't you just see? And to my heart, I'm down on one knee, my beautiful, sweet, sexy, my Marie.
Yeah. As a devotee of the musical, what do you think of its where it is these days? I mean, you have the super sophistication of Sondheim and his followers, and you have a lot of pandering that's going on Broadway, and this seems to have a kind of old-fashioned, back-to-romanticism feel to it.
It is a throwback, pure and simple. We wanted it to be a throwback. Many apologies to the musical practitioners who do the big shows, the big Broadway shows. I'm not interested in that. I never have been. I don't know how to do that. I loved watching, you know, Spamalot and having the confetti cannon fired at me. I love that kind of stuff. Don't get me wrong. And I love Sondheim. I revere Sondheim. The interesting thing about Sondheim is that musically, the people who have followed him and have followed that kind of music have produced a lot of tuneless shows. And I'm, again, as an artist, I'm not interested in that. I love those old forms, and I want this to be a return to those forms. Some people will sit there and call it hackneyed. Okay, so be it. It's a romantic comedy with romantic songs. That's all that we want it to be.
That's Paris by Night author Kurt Columbus speaking with Here Now's Ed Siegel. For more on the Trinity Rep Theater's production of Paris by Night, go to our website, here-now.org. And we take a moment to bid a fond adieu to Here and Now intern Kate Tai. Watch out, world, she's coming your way. Global warming and other enemies of the environment don't stand a chance. Kate, best to you as you grow and find your voice, and thank you. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.